My name is Luke Bretherton, and this is the Listen, Organise, Act podcast, which focuses on the history and contemporary practice of organising in democratic politics. Running alongside this specific focus are two others. The first is to explore how organising connects democracy and religion. The second is to examine how organising embodies a distinctive vision and practice of democratic politics. In each episode, I talk to those who live and breathe community organising about a different aspect of the work. The podcast itself is a collaboration between the Industrial Areas Foundation and the Keenan Institute for Ethics at Duke University. In this episode, I examine the second key tool organising uses for listening and building relationships, what they call the house meeting. As discussed in the previous episode on the one-to-one, listening and building relationships is foundational to how organising develops its distinctive approach to democratic politics, an approach that is bottom-up and relationally driven. In other words, an approach that puts people before programme. A politics that begins with listening and is attentive to the experience, conditions, and stories of people where they live and work needs practices for listening well. Along with the one-to-one, the house meeting is just such a practice. Initially developed by Fred Ross in the late 1940s, house meetings were further refined by Ross, Cesar Chavez, and Dolores Huerta in the early 1950s as a key element of the organizing work that spawned the United Farm Worker Movement in California. As a distinctive practice of organizing, it's been in continuous use ever since. In this episode, I discuss the history of the house meeting, what it is and why it matters, how to do it, some of the issues and problems that often come up when facilitating a house meeting, how it feeds into building power and affecting change, and how it contrasts with other approaches to listening and engaging people in democratic politics, such as focus groups and surveys. To discuss these questions, I talked to Tim McManus and Mary Elena Manzo. Tim has been with the IAF for over 13 years now, organizing in Dallas and Phoenix, before becoming the lead organizer for COPA, the IAF project in the central coast of California. He is currently building a new IAF organization in California's Central Valley. And before becoming an organizer, he was a high school teacher. Maria Elena was born in Mexico and came to the US aged 14. She was a farm worker going back and forth to Mexico until she was 30, after which she was able to settle in California. She's been a leader with COPA for almost 20 years and currently works as program manager for the Mujeres en Acción. And she tells me that she's the proud grandmother of 3.5, and she'll explain a bit of that later. So, join me now as I discuss the house meeting on this, the Listen, Organize, Act podcast. So, Maria Elena and Tim, it's great to have you with me on this, the Listen, Organize, Act podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about the house meeting and really appreciate you doing this. So just begin with you, Maria Elena. Can you tell me a little bit about where you grew up and kind of how you got into organizing? How did you encounter it and get involved in community organizing?
Well, I was born in Mexico. I came to the United States when I was 14 years old. And when I turned 16, I started working at the fields. We used to come every season to work on the fields and then go back home to Mexico. And I didn't stay in the United States until I was about 30. But when I was working at the fields, it was during the Cesar Chavez time. And it was the first time I had an opportunity to learn about doing something different with what you had. So I remember the marches that we will have. I think people started, I wasn't even sure what I was doing at that time, but I understand that people were walking from the Imperial Valley. And so they got to Central Valley and we started walking. We will walk from one city to another. One day we'll walk from one city and then go home and come back the next day where we left off and go all the way to from San Lucas to Salinas. And that was my first real interaction with any organizing. And after that, I became a crew rep and a delegate in one of the assemblies, but really, I was really young, not really knowing what I was doing. But it was just interesting, and I think that gave me a little an idea of what could happen when you organize. But like I said, at that time, it was fun. It was, and we did it, but not knowing enough what I was doing.
So how old were you when you got in, that was involved in the United Farm Worker Movement? What age was that then?
I think I was probably 17, 18 at that time. Yeah. So I guess after that, at first it was, yeah, we're on a strike. So we're not going to work today, but we're going to walk. And we were trying to get the company to let us have a labor, how you call it, a union, to be unionized.
Right. And so what, so how did you first encounter, so that was union-based organizing, obviously, yeah, amongst the farm workers. How did you kind of get involved in community organizing then?
Well, that's, for years, I didn't do anything else than, you know, if I, there was something I could do with, for my neighbors, but never involved in anything, nothing to do with politics. I moved to Salinas, back to the area in Salinas in 2001. And I remember for the first time, I wasn't going to be working. So I thought, this is time for me to get involved with my church. So I went to mass and they invited us to go to a meeting. And at this meeting, I always remember that they were talking about anger and they had a candle. And they turned off all the lights. They gave us each one of each a candle, and then they said the anger was like the fire. So right, you could light up a room, and they started lighting up all the candles, or you can burn a fire. And I thought, that's really interesting, you know. Right. And so I went there and to the meeting, and then I started meeting with the organizers and learning more, not sure what I was doing, but just thinking that, you know, this sounds very interesting.
And I just want to pick up on something we were talking about earlier, which is just to say a little bit about, you describe yourself as a grandmother having 3.5 grandchildren. Can you just explain the half?
Yeah, I have 2 granddaughters, a grandson, and another grandson on the way. So that's 3.5.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So Tim, turning to you, tell me a little about, because you were a teacher initially, and then the kind of journey from that into organizing. But begin a little bit about where did you grow up, and how did you kind of make that transition then from being a teacher to being an organizer?
Yeah, so I grew up mostly on the East Coast. I was born in New Jersey and grew up predominantly in Massachusetts. And I went to Boston College and studied theology and was trying to fit. I had been kind of immersed in Catholic social teaching and social justice and things like that through my education and some of my parish upbringing. And I was trying to figure out what to do with that, you know, how to put that into practice. And I went into teaching coming out of college, feeling like that was a pathway, an avenue to try to achieve social change, to try to make the city look different, make Boston look different, make the places I was working in look different. I did a teaching program that sent me down to Dallas, Texas, and it was there in Dallas that I first encountered organizing. I'd been teaching there for a number of years, and the neighborhood I was living in and teaching in, where most of the families that the students I was teaching were coming from, had just a lot of issues with safety, with neglect from the city, drugs and crime. And I was, as a teacher, trying to figure out what can we do about this, and what can the school do, and what can my neighborhood do? And, you know, I was meeting with other organizations and trying to figure out who was doing good work in this area and who could make some change, and really coming up empty, you know, not finding those kind of answers. And meanwhile, the problems were just getting worse and worse. And similar to what Maria Elena said, I mean, I came across organizing through my church. I was going to a small Catholic church in South Dallas, Holy Cross Catholic Church. And one Sunday, I took home the bulletin, and there was a little blurb in there about coming out to a meeting on Tuesday night to talk about safety in our neighborhood. And I always tell our leaders, don't rely on that. I'm probably the only one who's responded to a bulletin invite and shown up at something. And so, but I came out to this meeting because I was just, you know, racking my brain trying to figure out what we can do. And I had never seen anything like it. I walked into this room in my church And I watched these women from the choir, these readers from my church, these people who I saw every Sunday, these grandmothers running a powerful meeting. They had the city councilwoman and the police chief from Dallas, you know, right there in the room, telling these incredible stories about alleyways that hadn't been cleared for years, about car fires and police response times and drug houses, and demanding results, demanding change, setting timelines on that. When are you going to shut down the drug house? When are you going to clear those alleyways? And I just never seen anything like it. And sure enough, within a couple of weeks, the drug house was shut down. The alleyways were cleared. We had a commitment from the police chief about restructuring hiring and policing in Dallas. And that was my first exposure to organizing. Now, at the time, I noticed there was this man sitting in the back of the room taking some notes and seemed to be very involved in the meeting, but not at the center of it. And I introduced myself to him afterwards and found out he was an organizer with Dallas Area Interfaith, the IF project in Dallas. And I just asked him, what was this? I mean, how'd you do this? Tell me more about it. And I started meeting regularly with him, you know, a guy named Stephen Butler, and learned about this model and this approach to social change that I just never heard about, and became fascinated by it. And after a year as a leader with DAI in Dallas, I left teaching to take a job as an organizer there.
Right, right. Fantastic. Fantastic. So, Maria, Elena, tell me a little bit. We're kind of be focusing in this episode on the house meeting. What is a house meeting? Like, how would you, if you were going to invite someone to one, how would you define it, describe it, and what does it involve? Because I imagine most people listening to this podcast really won't have an idea. When you say house meeting, if they're anything like me, they think a kind of 90s rave and everyone dancing. So what is a house meeting?
Well, a house meeting is a small group conversation to understand what's happening in the community. It doesn't need to happen necessarily in the house. It can happen in the house, at the school, at the church, at the park, anywhere. And what we're trying to do is understand what's happening in the community. That's what we're trying to do. So the house meeting is some of the fundamental tools that the IEF has, and what it's aim at is to look for leaders and also to have an understanding of what's going on. You know, every community has its own suffering, pains, and anger. But in the house meeting, it's a chance, an opportunity, a place to make sense of what they're feeling, and also the possibility of a change, the imagination that something can be changed. So this is a space to learn and grow and create a strategy, also it's a tool for solidarity, because we can have people from different communities suffering from different pains or in the same community, but having different experiences of certain. One thing that I can share with recently in one of the house meetings, we were hearing stories, the story of Adriana, whose father passed away a couple months ago because he was a farm worker, older, with some underlying conditions. He had diabetes and still was working at the fields, and he died. Well, Jack Kirby is from completely different community, an Anglo, more affluent community. But listening to the story of Adriana made him think that even though he's at the age, he's probably over 75, and it's time for him to get the vaccine, there were more people that needed that vaccine at the fields. And so I remember him saying, if people tell me that I need to wait a couple more months for my vaccine, so people in the fields that need this vaccine more than I do, I will be willing to wait. Saved another Adriana's parents and from the fields, I will be willing to wait. So that's what we create in this house meeting. It's a listening to story and allowing the story to change you and move you to do different and do something in solidarity and see the vision that you can make changes together.
Right. Right. So I want to come back to the kind of practicalities question, but I want to turn to you, Tim, and have a think about the kind of history. You know, where did the house meeting come from? Who developed it? How was it developed? Can you say a little bit about its kind of origin story?
Sure. There was a man named Fred Ross, who was the first IAF organizer in California in the 1940s. He was tasked with going up and down the state of California and building what he called these community service organizations, you know, these IAF projects in California. And he, you know, while doing work, particularly around segregation issues in Southern California, discovered this tool of house meetings. And what he was trying to accomplish was figuring out, I mean, he had to build up from nothing. He had to build these organizations from nothing and go into a community where, you know, he does the white guy coming into a Mexican neighborhood in Southern California. And he had to figure out how he was going to build these things. And what his insight was that people have networks. People already have networks and they can bring those networks together. And that was how he was going to try to get into lots of conversations with people. I mean, a house meeting essentially is scaling up the conversations that you're having to a larger number of people. And so he would meet with somebody and say, is there anybody else that is concerned about this problem in the fields or this problem with segregation in the school district? And it would say, yeah, and I can pull some of those people together. And so in that person's home that night, that person would bring 10, 15, 20 people together from their work crew or relatives or people they knew in the town. And he would have these conversations where he would hear what was going on, but he would also start to lay out, well, what if we did this? You know, what if we registered voters, or what could we pull other people together and start to lay out some possibility. And as Maria Elena pointed out, to develop some imagination in these people. But it would always end with, okay, can we do another one of these tomorrow night? Who can pull people together tomorrow night? And somebody the next night would pull together their crew. And then somebody else would pull together their crew. And so after, you know, night after night after night of doing these house meetings, you could talk to hundreds of people. And it was in a setting where people felt comfortable talking. It was small enough size that, you know, people were willing to speak. They felt more comfortable. It was in somebody's home. It was somebody they trusted had invited them into it. But it was big enough that it felt like there was some energy there. And so, I mean, he was doing this to look for the leaders that would help him build these organizations. And, you know, in that process, he discovered some of the most talented and historic organizers that we know of, you know, people like Cesar Chavez or Dolores Huerta or Herman Gallegos, or these legendary organizers who went on together to build the farm worker movement came out of house meetings and learned how to teach and how to lead house meetings by working with Fred Ross.
Right. Like how, what was the kind of translation back into community organizing? Because obviously it was taken up in the farm workers, and for those who don't know the history, the CSO, Community Service Organization, then formed the seedbed, but then the United Farm Workers Union actually kind of separated from, became its own independent thing under the leadership of Chavez, Huerta, and others. But obviously then there were lessons learned. Can you tell me a little bit about how it came back into become such a central tool in community organizing?
I think the key aspect to that is the central to the IAF's broad-based organizing model is the organizing of institutions, of community-based institutions that can build the power to achieve change in a city, in a neighborhood, in a region. And to do that, you've got to get deeper into those institutions and find leaders in those institutions and build solidarity and create some imagination. And so they become a tool for organizing an institution, going back into a church and having dozens of house meetings to really build up the energy to move something forward. And that's very connected to the origin of these house meetings also. It just is the IAF's aim is not about building out a union. It becomes about how do we organize and agitate these institutions to live out their mission in the world. The way that in organizing we think about house meetings is how does this help us get into and dig deeper and look for leaders in the community-based institutions that exist and that could develop more power.
Right. So that sense then, it's identifying people who are embedded in existing networks, structures, ecologies of relationship, and have the trust and the kind of authority because people know them and therefore can draw people together. And if you someone can kind of get 20 people to their house on a rainy Thursday evening, then you can, that's a sure enough sign that someone's mm-hmm. got the trust and that's people right. will show up for them. And therefore, if you wanted them to show up for a meeting with the police chief or the mayor, they're also going to be able to bring those people and kind of draw them together. Yeah, no, that's, I think it's a very a kind of important sense. I think the other aspect of that that comes out of what you say is how the often we think of things like the clinic work or the church as either kind of private or merely service, but there's something there in the interrelationship between the faith-based institution, the service-based institution, and then how that forms the seedbed of more kind of explicitly political work and building of power. And we shouldn't kind of see them as a binary opposed, but actually there's a kind of interlacing of the two. You can't have one without the other. That, and the house meeting is the way in which they're stitched together, as it were, in that process. So Marie-Lena, can you just tell me a little bit about, particularly if we think back to the kind of origins of COPA and its development as a coalition, which you were involved in from the outset. Can you give me some examples of when and where house meetings were key in developing that coalition, and kind of some examples of how they helped shape and develop a campaign that COPA did?
Yeah, well, I can share about the Esperanza Care. It's a healthcare program for undocumented in Monterey County. And that happened because of the house meetings. We started having house meetings, listening to stories, and we learned that there was a gap. There was this need of health care, and that there was enough energy to address it. So identify a leader that will be willing to work on that, and that they were connected to the institutions, to the churches, and we started having house meetings, and we were able to bring stories from those house meetings to the director of the health department, together with all the leaders from different institutions, and bringing to the health department a story that they didn't know, that they were doing a really good job. There was one meeting specifically with the director of the health department, with some clergy and some lay leaders that were at this meeting, where we shared the stories of people, and I was able to share the story of being an asthma educator, of how if I had to do a home visit with an undocumented child from Monterey County, trying to develop a plan for their asthma, the only plan that I could give him is wait until you have a severe episode, go to the emergency room so they can give you the medication that you need, and repeat, you know, once they get back home and feel better, and then go back when you have a flare-up again. Different from going to do a home visit in Santa Cruz County, where they have a healthy kids program, where they were covered, and I could develop a program. And the director of the health department was shocked to hear this. He had no idea this was happening. He thought they were covering. He actually told me, no, we do cover asthma medication. I said, yeah, you cover the emergency, the albuterol, which is emergency medication, but you do not cover the controlled medication, which is what they need to prevent them from going to the emergency room. Yeah, I mean, he didn't know this information. He thought that they were doing good. And by the end of the meeting, he offered to set aside, you know, I was saying they don't cover, these kids don't have the access to medication. And so his proposal was, what if we put $50,000 aside for medication in a county? That's nothing, right? But that started the conversation. So we continue having house meetings and bringing the stories and creating a strategy, developing the leadership for leaders like me that had never been involved in politics to come to the supervisor and say, we need, these are the stories that we're hearing, and making it happen. So we started a pilot for $500,000 to have some medications, some tests done. But we continue. We continue having the house meetings and seeing the gaps. I get my testing, but what do I do with it if I don't have access to a specialist? So we continue doing the house meetings, strategizing, meeting with elected officials until they establish Esperanza Care with $2 million a year to cover 3,500 undocumented members with a full scope of primary health care and access to specialists, a bigger set of tests that could be done and more medication. And all this happened because of that. Then we continue having meetings, and then we're troubleshooting and noticing that people were getting bills, even though they were part of this. Right. So instead of one person fighting for that bill that they got, we were able to, through all these house meetings and the conversation, make a systemic change where they fix the glitch and we're able to do that.
Right. So it's both this element of solidarity, of building a relationship, but there's kind of intelligence gathering. There's a sense in which you're finding out the real issues rooted in the lived experiences of the people who are affected by these policies or by these institutions. And therefore, not only kind of identify an issue everyone's willing to work on, but actually then in the story you've told, I think very powerfully, also ensure that that policy is rolled out in an effective way that actually genuinely helps. It isn't a kind of tokenistic gesture, but actually then you can kind of, it helps with the accountability process. Is that right?
Yeah. And teaching leaders like me, you know, just a lay person to come in and learn of what is to do a research action and what do you need to learn to be able to make the changes rather than standing outside the city hall and with a poster and say, we need help. You know, how do we have these conversations and organize and learn to strategize?
Right. Tim, you want to? Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, Luke, that's an important insight about house meetings. At the heart of our organizing model is this belief that people in communities, people on the ground, know what's going on and they know what they need and they know what's best for their communities. And if they can build some power, you know, that they can drive that kind of change that they really need. And what we find all the time, and especially with government and politicians, is they can be very disconnected from how things are playing out on the ground. They do not understand those gaps. They don't understand why this nice fancy program aimed to help poor people or help immigrants isn't really working. And they blame it on a whole bunch of other things besides the fact that they just haven't fully, you know, listened to what's going on with people and how they could better serve it, how to tweak these programs and modify them. And so house meetings can try to close that gap. I mean, one thing that we've been doing a lot of lately is asking elected officials to commit to, and department heads and other government leaders to commit to just sitting in house meetings and listening. And right now we're also doing that with police chiefs and police unions around policing issues in particularly in immigrant communities and some of the gaps that they might not understand of how people are experiencing policing.
Right. So there's a sense there that, I mean, because often we can frame the relationship with public officials or business officials in this very conflictual terms. And I think that often is the case. There has to be agitation to get recognition before there can be meaningful relationship and collaboration. But often in the story you were saying, Marie-Lena, that the official themselves thought they were doing a good thing. They had a big data set. They had probably a very good education in public health matters. And that all said to them that they were doing a good program or, you know, at least as good as they thought they could. And so in a sense, through the house meetings and through the stories and the experiences this surfaces, you're able to bring this to them and they, it's in a sense, their self-interest to respond. They're trying to do, you know, develop a good program and therefore through cooperation with COPA, they were able to develop a more effective program. And that's certainly something I've saw in the London context, working with the King's Health Partners, which is kind of a very large provider of healthcare in the whole of South London. And there, the collaboration with London Citizens was able to develop a much more extensive process of public health rooted in a process of listening and engaging with and building up leaders to work with them to deliver kind of public health work in that context in a way in which they were tending to do programs which weren't actually connecting to people. So I think that kind of a sense of shared interest emerging between the you know, in this case, the health system and the people they're supposed to be serving is one thing that can emerge out of this. Tim, can you just tell me a little bit, because I've done an early episode on the one-to-one. How do you see the relationship between the one-to-one and the house meeting? And can you narrate a little bit about how they work together, the kind of different roles, tasks they fulfill in organizing?
Well, they go hand in hand in the sense that, you know, as Maria Elena lifted up earlier, the primary goal of a house meeting is to surface leaders, is to identify new potential leaders. And so when you lead a house meeting, you need to come out of that house meeting with a couple of people you want to do one-on-one relational meetings with. So if I've got 10 people in a room and I'm having this house meeting and I'm finding out what's going on with people and who's angry and who's got some energy, I better leave that meeting with on my calendar, you know, times that I'm going to meet with those couple of most interesting people. You know, there's a selectivity about it. And you're looking for who, you can't do one-on-one meetings with everybody. And so a house meeting can help you surface people you want to spend more time with, because in the relational meeting, that's when you can really dig deeper into understanding this person's interests and what do they want to do? And how does this fit in with what your interests are, what you're thinking about? And you're starting to imagine, you know, what could you be doing back in your institution, or how could we advance it? And so the conversation, the depth that you could get into in a one-on-one, you can't quite in a house meeting. And so in a house meeting, you're having these mini relational meetings, mini one-on-ones with 6, 8, 10 people, you know, that you're mixing it up. You're getting reactions, you're getting them react to each other, but you're trying to see who from this group do I need more time with? And so, and then it goes, back the other direction. You do a relational meeting with somebody who looks interesting. You might ask them, can you pull together a house meeting? Who else is like you in your church? Who else is like you in your neighborhood? Who else cares about this thing? Could you pull together a house meeting? And as you said earlier, if that person can get 10 people into a room, that's kind of interesting. You know, they've got a network. They've got people show up on a rainy Thursday night to their room. I mean, that's kind of interesting. And so the two work together really well. You do house meetings to get into relational meetings. You do relational meetings to see who can pull together house meetings. And they keep on building up this energy and this base of an organization.
Right. So one thing that strikes me, I mean, there'd be some modes of campaigning and mobilizing folk, which would, you'd have a house meeting and you would kind of take everyone's email addresses and put them on a kind of list. And then you would kind of send them alerts to get them to turn out to different things. I'm struck there's a real difference then in approach between that kind of thing I've just outlined and what you were saying. I mean, do you take people's emails at a house meeting? That sounds so silly, but like, it seems like this is a very slow process, you know, that is being engaged in here. And why, you know, why this approach?
Yeah. I mean, you're definitely building up a network. I mean, so absolutely. Take emails and you follow up with people and you invite people to things. And the 10 people you had at your house meeting, you might invite all 10 of them to the next time you're bringing hundreds of people out to the county board of supervisors meeting. I mean, so that is there's an element to that, but that's not the goal. The goal is to find, right. I mean, who's my next Maria Elena in Salinas? How do I find her successor in her church? And that's what you're after. And, you know, we have an iron rule in organizing, never do for others what they can do for themselves. And so different from that campaign approach that you're describing, that many of us maybe have been on those email lists you end up getting from a candidate or a politician or a campaign, they're interested in getting the information that will help them move their agenda or campaign or whatever forward. We're interested in servicing you know, the potential leader and what you want to do. And working with you to shape that and shape that agenda. And so there's a different approach and certainly requires more patience and more deliberation. But it's really about servicing people and figuring out what they've got some energy for.
Right. So turning now to the kind of concrete practice, Marilena, can you say a little bit about, you know, if you were going to set up a one-to-one in preparation for a campaign or kind of building a coalition, how would you determine who should be there? And kind of very practical, sounds silly and obvious, but very practical questions of how would you go about thinking about when it should be held, where it should be held? Should it be held in someone's house or in a church hall? Or how do you think about those kinds of factors, very practical factors?
Well, you have to go where people can be, you know, if we have a group or a leader that is willing to do or wants to do a house meeting to find people that are willing to work with her or him, if she wants to meet at the house, that's where we meet at the house. Or if they don't have a space, we'll go to the church, we'll go to the park, whatever it is. The space is not important. We even have been doing it now through Zoom, you know. We'll do small groups through Zoom and so whatever is needed, that's where we go. Right. You know, the place is not important. It's who you're meeting with and who can bring those leaders.
Yeah. Right. Tim, you want to say something?
The other way to come at it is to look at where people are already congregating and gathering within an institution, but they're not yet being organized. The Esperanza Care story that Marilena was sharing, one of our key places for doing house meetings was at St. Francis Xavier Catholic Church in Seaside, because every Tuesday night, they had a charismatic prayer group of undocumented immigrants predominantly that would meet for a couple hours. And there were 200 people there every Tuesday night.
Right.
Now, right. Some of the key leaders pulling together that prayer group had been involved and been in house meetings, and they, you know, knew the importance of this and they wanted to help. And so they would start their Tuesday night prayer meeting by, for 30 minutes, organizing people into house meetings and get people into groups of 8 or 10 to share their story. And so every Tuesday night, we were able to then meet with 200 people to hear their stories about healthcare access and other concerns. Those people were already gathered. They were already, you know, together in person and relating to each other, but it didn't have this particular focus to it. And it wasn't, about advancing some of their material needs around mm-hmm. healthcare access. And so looking at an institution and figuring out where are there already networks and people, whether that's a ministry, whether that's at services themselves, or at a council meeting, whatever it is, and seeing, can we turn this into a different type of conversation than this group might be used to?
Right. I think it's a great insight. The question of often it's a kind of if we build it, they will come kind of approach. Like, we're going to have this meeting over here, and then we've got to persuade a whole bunch of people to kind of come to some place that's an inconvenient time and an inconvenient place with people they don't feel particularly connected to. Whereas what you're saying is actually identifying, where are people already gathering? What are people already have energy for? Where's the energy already flowing? And then engaging with people where they're at, rather than all the time demanding they come to where you're at. I think that's a very, very, very key point. So Marilena, Elena, just can you say a little bit? I mean, it's an odd thing to say to someone, come over to the church hall or come to my house and we're going to have this conversation. It's not a Tupperware party. It's not a come over for a bit of cake and coffee. You know, it's a very particular kind of conversation. And how do you broach that for someone who's never done that kind of invitation before? How do you kind of broach that and say, hey, it's not going to be weird. Come over.
Well, the first thing is like Tim is saying, you already have your network. You already have the people that you see at church and that you see at the school, so that's what you're bring your network, you know, who is part of this of your network, and definitely like in my case, sometimes you don't know, you haven't had that experience, you're not sure what it is.
So just, I mean, at a very practical level, you know, do you set the chairs out in a circle? How do you begin the meeting? Like, talk me through the kind of process of running a house meeting from kind of beginning to end, as people are coming through the door to when you say goodbye to them at the end. Can the both of you just lay out for me how one actually goes about running a good house meeting? What's the kind of vibe? Give in a kind of idealized, obviously things are very adaptive to context and different situation, but in a kind of ideal world, how would one go around structuring a meeting like that, and from how you do the opening to how you do the closing? Tim, if I begin with you and then Marie-Elena, I'll come to you.
I think the first important thing is you've got to have somebody who is the leader of a house meeting. So somebody has committed to leading a house meeting, and they're not a facilitator. They're a leader, and there's a key difference in how you think about the conversation. But it also helps to have somebody else with you who can be helpful as a note taker or a timekeeper or somebody else who can help you process and evaluate the meeting. So when people can do this in pairs, that helps a lot. So if I'm the house meeting leader, that I might recruit Marilena to come along with me to be my note taker. We don't want our house meeting leader to take notes. We don't want them to be thinking about other things that, because they've got to really run an agitational conversation with people that they're bringing together. So they, when they start the meeting, these don't have to take longer than 30, 45 minutes, an hour at tops. You start the meeting and you get everybody to introduce themselves, even if you think you already know each other and you've been in the room together, but to go around and ask people to introduce themselves, giving them a first opportunity to get into the conversation. Maybe even asking them, you know, how many kids do you have at the school? Or how long you've been part of this parish? Or how long have you lived here? You know, but something that allows people to enter into the conversation, to have their voice heard right at the outset. The leader then goes through some ground rules. We've got a limited time. We're going to have a conversation tonight about how housing prices are squeezing people out of this neighborhood. And we want to hear your stories, your experiences around that. But to keep us on time and keep us on that question, I want to ask your permission to interrupt. Would that be okay with everybody if I interrupt? That piece of the agenda is really, really critical. The leader asking people's permission to interrupt, setting the tone early on that I'm going to be jumping in the middle of it. I'm going to be mixing it up. And this is not a passive conversation that I'm going to be getting in there. And I might have to cut you off to get to somebody else, or I might stop you for a follow-up question because I don't understand your story, or I want to get more detail out of it. But getting consent from everybody else on that at the beginning is important. So going through some basic ground rules, some expectations around time, and stressing to people that this is not a conversation where we're going to solve everything or theorize about the solutions to things. We just want to hear people's experiences. And then we'll talk about some next steps of how we might go about doing something about this. And just being really clear up front with people on that. But I also think it's important that the leader of a house meeting model what they're talking about to start out, that they share their own story and experience first to set the tone. So if I'm leading a house meeting, that I set up the question, but then I also tell my own experience around how I'm getting squeezed out because of housing prices, and that you give people a sense of what it is that this conversation is going to be like. Now, then the conversation happens, and it's got to be, it is not a passive one after another. Everybody take their turn. Everybody gets their 2 minutes. You say what you're going to say, and we move on. This has to be an energetic, engaging conversation, and the house meeting leader is responsible for making that happen. So that means interrupting. It means asking questions. It means getting people to react to each other. You know, Marilena, what do you think about what Luke just said? Do you agree with that? Is that true? I don't know. I haven't heard that. Is that really true in this neighborhood? But getting people to engage with each other and starting to get a feel of who's angry enough about this, who's concerned enough about this that they want to do something. They don't want to just complain. They want to try to change it and be part of that. Right. And so at the end of the meeting, you're getting a chance to, you can go through some of the notes and what did we hear tonight? How was this conversation for people? But that there are very clear potential next steps coming out of it. You know, we're going to have a follow-up conversation about housing next week. Who's going to come to that? Getting people that you're going to meet one-on-one, but there's always it's got to go somewhere, or else people will be wondering, well, I just shared all that. What's ever going to happen from it? Why we didn't do that? What's the point? That's a simple overview of kind of a house meeting agenda. And again, that can all happen in a good 45 minute session and with some good energy in it, and people leave knowing where it's going.
Right. Maria Elena, how would you kind of close out a meeting? Like, is it, you know, obviously if it's in a church context, do you say prayer or I mean, how would you, when there's been people of sharing stories, and some of them might be quite tender stories or difficult stories or, you know, traumatic stories, how do you kind of draw things to a close or kind of give people a sense of, okay, now we've gone and now it's on to next steps?
Yeah, well, if it's at a church, then, you know, most of the time we start with the prayer and then with the prayer, you know, so yeah. But like Tim said, having a next step, knowing that the story that they shared that was really painful is not going to stop there, but how is it going to, what's next?
Right. So I guess that's quite key then. It's not just a kind of, this is happening to me. That next step then gives people a sense of agency. We can act and we can act together. And actually we're building something together to address this situation. It isn't just a kind of care and share sort of, you know, gatherings. It's this is building towards shared action. I guess that's a very key element then of having that, you know, move towards another moment. So stay with you, Marilena. Can you just say a little bit about like what inevitably one encounters blowhards, people who want to dominate the meeting. How do you deal with them? Like, how do you deal with the people who just want to be it all about them in the meeting? And what are some of the other ways in which house meetings can go wrong? And some of the kind of ways you found over the years to kind of address those awkward moments.
That's why it's so important what Tim said. They already gave you permission to interrupt, so you interrupt. You know, so let's hear. Yeah, that's really good. Let's hear what Adriana wants to say or has to say. One of the things that will tell you that your meeting didn't go the way you planned it is that you go home, you leave with homework. You know, you leave the house meeting, and then you have to go home and investigate what is the program that is going to help with this, or you're going to have. When we leave the house meeting, we all have everybody has to have a next step. So are you willing to host another house meeting? Are you going to, but they have to have something else to do. But if I'm the leader of the house meeting and I go home with homework, that means that it went wrong. I didn't do my job. I didn't have a number. I didn't schedule any one-on-ones. Then that didn't work. You know, it was just gathering, not a house meeting.
Right. So what are some of the kind of things you've seen go wrong in house meetings? Have you addressed them?
Well, there's definitely that. I mean, there are people who are just going to get off agenda and theorize and tell you the NPR story they heard the other day, or, you know, it's going to be that. And Muddy Lane is right on. I mean, that's why you got to get permission to interrupt, so that you're not necessarily trying to salvage that person. You're trying to salvage the rest of the group so they understand why you cut that person off or why you stopped listening to them. You know, so that becomes important. I think so there are ways they can just be really frustrating. I think mostly the problem is if they're thought of as a gathering of information and a gathering of issues and stories and not thought of as a recruitment of leaders. And I think that happens much more often than the more disruptive type of house meetings is that, I know, you know, we've called them, or others will call them at times, listening sessions, that where our parish is going to do listening sessions. That implies this sort of, you know, passive, we're just going to gather what the needs are here. And then, you know, to Marilena's point, the same group of people takes what they just learned and all the notes and all the needs that are out there and then goes and tries to fix them. So I think that to me is where these can go wrong the most, is if they're just thought of that way, that they're about gathering information, gathering issues, and developing an agenda for the organization. They have to be about finding talent. They've got to be about finding leaders and figuring out what those leaders are going to do and giving them assignments to go do it and getting them moving. That's got to be what a house meeting is for. And so I think the biggest mistake that gets made is they're thought of more as this passive listening approach to the issues and not about surfacing talent.
Right. So in a sense, they kind of devolve into a kind of focus group. So mm-hmm. It's just one people coming along, listening, you know, and thereby hearing important stories and getting intelligence about what's going on here amongst these people in this place at this time. But then those same people go away and they're the ones who have the agency. They're the ones who interpret it. They're the ones who are kind of then see themselves as tasked with addressing it, rather than the meeting being the means by which we discover together both our own agency, our willingness to act together, and some ways in which we can discern and discover what we're going to do together and kind of what tactics or strategies are going to kind of emerge out of the conversation. So yeah, that's a very helpful. And could just draw out a little bit more then, how you see that contrast between focus group kind of approach and a house meeting.
Well, what you just described, the result of that, it creates two problems. One, the team of leaders, the existing leaders and organizers just get incredibly burnt out because they're hearing all this stuff and they can't figure out what to work on next or how are we going to do this. And now people are concerned about that and what are we going to do with it? You know, and it's just exhausting. I mean, to keep hearing these things and thinking you're the one that's got to go fix it. I mean, it can create incredible problems. The other is on what it does to your community, to your parish, your neighborhood, where you've just told people a bunch of the things that are going on, but they haven't fixed it yet. You know, what happened? We told you this, and what are you doing about it? And I thought you said you were going to do something. And it teaches people that somebody else has to solve their problems for them. But it also creates this incredible dissatisfaction with people that, well, we shared all those things. We told you that policing is a problem here. What are you doing about it? Why haven't we heard anything from the team? You know, and so it just, it divides up, you know, who the leaders are, who the people going through these things. And so you've got to try to break through that. And that comes from surfacing new leaders and getting them busy, getting them doing some work.
Right. So that focus on shared action rather than one set of people being listened to and another set of people going off and doing the action on their behalf. Mm-hmm. No, that's very helpful. Maria Elena, can you say a little bit about then as house meetings move into developing that ability to act together? Can you expand a little bit about how house meetings are connected to building power? How do they enable the generation of this power to act together?
I'm going to use the example of Esperanza Care again. We had people that were telling us the story of their struggles, but we had people from another area of Monterey I remember one of the bishops saying, I have never in my whole life been without a health insurance. So just having people on every side sharing their story and acting together, because we have people, if we're going to pass something like this, we needed people, we needed all the supervisors to pass to approve Esperanza Care. So we needed people that was in the peninsula that didn't need any help care. They have their own health care, but they're in solidarity with the stories that they're hearing, and we get the power because now we have all the supervisors that are going to approve. We're meeting with them and their constituents of this supervisors, so they have the power to push everybody to move this, and so that's what it is. I remember at the launch in Esperanza Care when one of the supervisors, Supervisor Parker, said, just want you to know that this happened because of COPA. COPA came and told me about a program and came back and told me about a solution and keep coming and coming. So this will not happen if it wasn't for COPA. This is not something that we as supervisors developed, but this is something that you all leaders did. This happened because of you. So that's power.
So I've done another episode for the series on popular education. And one of the things you've both been talking about is and particularly you, Maria Elena, how you came to understand more about how health systems, the finances of that worked through the process of house meetings. Can you just comment a little bit about how the house meeting functions as an educational process? How does it serve to build up what we might call popular education and an understanding of the kind of conditions under which one lives and works?
Well, what you do at the house meeting is identify the leaders and then give them the opportunity. I was given the opportunity to come and meet with the supervisor. But preparing ourselves before the meeting, knowing exactly what was my role and what I needed to do. And at the beginning, it was to come and tell the story, you know. But later on, as I understand more, figuring out strategies and how can we get to this and talking about learning where there's money and at meeting with the supervisors and finding the ally that is going to help you understand where there's money that can be moved and it can be switched to cover this need that is there. So it's learning all those things. I mean, if you would have told me years ago that I was going to be meeting and understanding all these things, there's still things that are hard for me to understand, but that's why we have other leaders. So we all together we're all working together, and each person brings their own one part that is needed, and just understanding that is very important. So I have learned so many things. I wouldn't even know who my congressman was or my supervisor, and now I know who is what district and who needs it, who can we count on depending on what we're doing. I have an insight of those things, and that would not have been possible if not for COPA.
Right, right. So that connection then of, in a sense, the kind of personal story, rooted experience, and the kind of technical knowledge about how things and systems and structures and institutions are working, that's in a sense, it's not the technical knowledge acting on people's living and working experience. It's the marriage of these two things together that then actually generates policy ideas and strategies and ways of taking things forward that are actually rooted in the realities of what's going on rather than kind of imposed on them. That's, you know, it's very, 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 very interesting. So can you just, Tim, can you just lay out for us a little bit about how you see House meetings embodying a particular vision of democratic politics? How is the House meeting, in a sense, in its practice, a sense of what democratic politics should be about?
My supervisor, Ernesto Cortez, calls House meetings the crucible of democracy. Democracy depends on the citizenry or the people being able to deliberate over community decisions and resource allocation and what's best for structuring a society. And we don't really have those kind of spaces to do that. We most of us, you know, and maybe in the halls of government that can happen or board meetings, but for the most part, you know, most of us don't have this space to do that. And a House meeting at its best is this place where we're coming together and laying out our different experiences around how something's playing out in our neighborhood. And doing that with other people that maybe have had similar experiences, maybe have had different experiences, and we're starting to have that deliberation that out of that, out of those conversations and many others like them, will start to shape an idea of how things could be better. You know, why does it have to be like this? I mean, if we're all dealing with that and it's not working, what could we be doing different? And so it's the kind of birthplace of where those type of changes are going to come from. And, you know, and when they're connected to power and a power strategy that can actually lift up that vision in a way that decision makers have to respond to it, then it can lead to real democratic decision making. But a House meeting is really the way, a real way that people can do that and do that in a way that puts them in relationship to other people who they're sharing this geography with, you know, this place with. I mean, I've seen this you know, development lately with politicians wanting, you know, developing apps and software and technology to get people to say what they need and what they want. And it's, you know, it's a good way to get information, but it's a terrible way to develop a democratic culture where people are actually having to do that in conversation with each other. And that's what a House meeting ought to be.
Yeah. I think the difference between gathering information and generating shared wisdom, they're two entirely different kind of strategies and approaches and visions of what democratic politics is about. The one is rooted in, quite rightly, in a sense of representative democracy. We need to find out what people are thinking and then go and act on that in the Congress or Senate or whatever. But that's very different from a democratic culture of shared deliberation and wisdom generation about who are we together in this, what are the issues that are affecting us, and how can we act together to address them and get our needs met and ensure that there is a more just and generous community that we're living in. And I think these are very different kind of orientations to democracy.
And it's also a place where we learn what belongs in the public realm. I mean, what things in our lives belong in a public conversation. A lot of times we don't think that these things we're going through belong in the public discourse. We think it's about us. We think it's about our failures, our mistakes, our problems that we've got to try to fight through, and we don't recognize that it's part of some larger collective need that exists out there. And a House meeting could do that. When I remember this very sharply during the foreclosure crisis, where all these people were struggling and losing homes, and there was this incredible shame and disappointment and sadness. And in House meetings, people could start to realize, wait a second, it's happening to you too, and it's happening to you. And maybe it wasn't just because I made bad decisions in my life. Maybe there's something else going on here. And so just start to recognize what ought to be part of a public discourse versus what's just the thing that I need to work out on my own is important. And a House meeting can create that sense of collectivism, you know, where this is bigger than just me.
Right, right. So that sense of a kind of a private grief becoming a public story, that's right. Then the sense that I'm recognizing there is a systemic, an institutional dimension mm-hmm. to that isn't just my, you know, bad decisions about, you know, mortgage lending. Maria Elena, you had a...
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I was frustrated when I was doing this home visits to people with asthma, but I didn't know that I had any power to do anything. And the house meeting was a university of civic engagement and showed me that I could have power. I mean, there was a lot of people, very educated people in that meeting that I'm describing, and I was the one that had the power to switch the conversation because of the story that I shared. So it's learning where the power is and knowing that you can actually have the power to make changes to people that are just lay people. And so using the house meetings as a university of learning of the your role and what can you do. And that's what will lead to democracy.
Right. Fantastic. So, Maria Elena and Tim, thank you so much for joining me on the Listen, Organize, Act podcast. It's been great talking to you and a rich and insightful conversation about the nature of the House meeting and its broader role in organizing.
Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Listen, Organize, Act podcast, in which I explored the House meeting and its key role in community organizing and generating the capacity to act together for change. As with other episodes, I'll be putting some suggestions for further reading in the show notes on the website. But for now, let me say goodbye, and I hope you join me next time as I continue this journey through the different elements of community organizing and how it embodies a distinctive vision of democratic politics. Goodbye.